Welcome back to Silicon Bites. In this episode 39, we're going to look at a whole range of topics, including what has become absolutely critical for Ukraine, and that is getting more air defense supplies before Russia is able to take out more of its energy infrastructure. Before we turn to that, let's have a roundup of some of the latest news stories. Ukraine continues to pile pressure on Russia's fuel oil refining capacity by striking an oil refinery deep inside Russia. This will be one of the longest range attacks that it has achieved so far. There are also reports coming in that Ukraine has attacked the Shahed drone factory, again, deep inside Russia. If true, this could be a tremendous blow to Russia's war effort. A drone-making facility deep inside Russian territory was bombarded on Tuesday morning, according to local officials. Drones attacked production facilities in Yelabuga and Nizhekamensk in Russia's Tatarstan Republic. That is some 1,500 kilometers from the border with Ukraine. And as we mentioned, a Ukrainian long-range drone hit the primary oil processing facility at the Nizhekamensk refinery, after which a fire broke out. Now, this is one of Russia's largest refineries, and Ukrainian officials are quoted as saying, "We continue to work systematically to ensure that Russia has fewer and fewer opportunities to finance the war of aggression against Ukraine. We will continue to cut off oxygen to the gas station country to minimize the flow of petrodollars to the military budget of the Russian Federation." This, of course, is an incredibly powerful strategy. And really, perhaps for the first time in this war, it's a strategy that is really piling the pressure on Russia's domestic economy, but of course, its ability to power its war machine. This has really got Moscow frightened. Therefore, this ought to be a strategy that we fully get behind. Well, we're going to come to that in a minute, because it seems that not everybody on the Allies' side is entirely happy with Ukraine's strategy. Now, last year in July, it was reported that Iran was helping Russia to build a drone factory in Yelabuga, citing US intelligence data released by the White House. Russia uses home-produced Shahed-type drones that it calls Geran to attack Ukrainian energy and civilian infrastructure on an almost daily basis. Now, that attack on the production facility seems to have caused casualties on the Russian side. One assumes that it is workers in those facilities, but collateral injuries cannot, of course, be ruled out. Now, this, of course, is an absolutely legal target for Ukraine to strike. It is part of Russia's war machine. It is part of the machine that is attacking Ukraine, trying to snuff out its identity. This isn't illegal by war in Russia, but this kind of strike by Ukraine is entirely permissible under international law. What Russia does, however, targeting civilian energy infrastructure, is not defined as legal under those same statutes. And we have to look at why these attacks are so critical at this time, because we've entered a phase of the war where Ukraine is fighting for its survival, as it was in those first weeks and months of the war back in 2022. This has also prompted Volodymyr Zelensky to give one of his most hard-hitting speeches yet in 2 years of full-scale warfare. "Ukraine retreat looms without US support," says Zelensky. "Attackums are the answer. Ukraine's armed forces could soon be forced to retreat further if US military aid continues to be delayed," President Volodymyr Zelensky said, as he called on Washington to provide more long-range missiles to strike airfields in occupied Crimea. Now, this was an interview he gave in the Washington Post, and Zelensky said his military had been unable to plan any counteroffensive operations in the current year, as they do not know if they'll have the weapons required to conduct one. "If you're not taking steps forward to prepare another counteroffensive, Russia will take one instead," he said, adding that what we have learned in this war is if you don't take the initiative, then Russia will. And there is a good example of this over the weekend. We'll report on this in the next Silicon Bites as more information comes to light. But it seems that Russia has made one of its largest tank assaults on Ukrainian positions over the weekend, and that assault was not just beaten back, but was annihilated. As we get more information, we will, of course, share that with you. But this could be a significant development because reports suggest that a significant chunk of Russia's intact tank fleet may have been decimated in that attack. But it's also illustrative that if Ukraine is not pushing back, Russia will continue its meat wave assault, continue its armored assaults, because Putin will be given the false impression that he can win. And if Putin thinks he can win, he will continue throwing bodies and metal at the Ukrainian front lines in the hopes of a breakthrough. In addition to facing dwindling supplies of air defense missiles, Ukraine has also had a lack of long-range missiles with which it could target the air bases from which Russian bomber aircraft take off. When Russia has missiles and we don't, they attack by missiles. They attack everything: gas, energy, schools, factories, civilian buildings, said Volodymyr Zelensky, adding that ATACMS-300s, they are the answer. And what he means here is not just defending against Russian attacks, but it is imperative to strike Russia at the source of the attacks, the air bases where those planes take off from, the missile sites where those missiles are launched from. This is imperative, not just for Ukraine to win, but simply to survive at this point in the full-scale war. Now, newer ATACMS have a maximum range of around 300 kilometers. And of course, as we know, they have not yet been supplied to Ukraine, nor have the Taurus capability from Germany. When Russia knows we can destroy these planes, said Zelensky, they will not attack from Crimea. It's like the Black Sea Fleet. We pushed them from our territorial waters. Now we will push them from the airports in Crimea as well. Now, this is sound strategic thinking. And it's important that Ukraine has this capability. US and German fears in supplying this weaponry. Primarily, the fear seems to be that Ukraine will use these weapons against Russians on Russian soil. But Ukraine has shown itself very, very capable to follow Western requests and not use these weapons outside of its own sovereign territories. Why allies don't trust Ukraine at this point to be able to do that is a mystery, unless, of course, they are still being coerced by Russia's nuclear blackmail, which I think is highly likely. We'll tackle that one in just a minute. And one of the reasons why these missiles are so important and air defense systems can be seen by what has happened in Kharkiv after the last couple of days. Ukraine's critical infrastructure targeted in overnight Russian attack, reports the Kyiv Independent. Russia attacked Ukraine with drones and missiles on March the 31st, damaging infrastructure facilities and killing at least one person. Russian troops hit Ukraine with drones and missiles, including 11 Shahed drones, 14 cruise missiles, and Kh-59 missiles. The inventory of offensive weaponry thrown at Ukraine goes on and on. But what makes this attack incredibly significant is that Russia seems to have destroyed almost all of the energy infrastructure in Kharkiv, the mayor says. Now, for those of you who are fortunate enough not to watch Russian weaponized propaganda, only a few days before this attack, several of the propagandists called for Kharkiv to be wiped out. They called for its utilities, including energy and water, to be taken out, thereby forcing its population to either flee or cower in basements. Now, that is a clear war crime. It's a clear call to genocide. And only a few days later, it seems that they were providing a prediction of Russia's actual strategy, and that is to siege Kharkiv, siege the population, and of course, they hope to eventually take that city. Whether it is taken intact or as a pile of rubble like Mariupol, I doubt whether the Russians in reality care. Russian attacks destroyed almost all energy infrastructure in Kharkiv, Mayor Ihor Tirikhov said in an interview with Liga Media Output, published on April the 1st. Kharkiv has been at the forefront of Russian attacks since the outbreak of the full-scale invasion and has seen an escalation in strikes in recent weeks. The attacks destroyed a thermal power plant and all the electrical substations in Ukraine's second biggest city. When asked about the reasons for the intensified strikes, the mayor answered he did not know what Russia's plan was. But if we listen to the propagandists, we have a fair idea what they're hoping to achieve. The current situation for the energy industry in the city is very difficult, according to the mayor. The humanitarian assistance centres, also known as the points of invisibility, work in Kharkiv around the clock. We've been through more rough times, and we will survive these times too, Tirikhov said. Well, we can only hope that Kharkiv is ably supported by its own citizens and by the government in Kiev, and that the people there find a way to get through this energy embargo that Russia is trying to impose. And of course, many of you watching this channel will know that there are several of the guests on the channel who are in the Kharkiv area or around, Joseph Lindsley, Ada Wordsworth, and several others. We wish them well in these difficult times. And this is why a report, as we've covered in the Financial Times, about US apparently putting pressure on Ukraine not to attack Russian oil refineries for fear of, quote, retaliation, is a fairly absurd thing. Now, we've had comments, and I expect to get many more comments in this video saying that this story wasn't true and there's no basis to it and blah, blah, blah. But it does seem from recent comments by Zelensky and from several people who are extremely well connected, guests of this channel that I've reached out to, it does seem there is some foundation to this story, that there is intense disquiet in Washington about Ukraine's strategy to strike oil refineries and to destroy its domestic fuel production. I say domestic, but of course, a big chunk of it is used to power Russia's war machine. Now, the story originally appeared in the Financial Times. There has been quite a bit of debate about it. But I think it's important to note whether Ukraine strikes Russian oil facilities or not will not affect whether Russia continues to strike Ukraine. Russia's stated objectives and its actions on the ground show that it wants to destroy Ukrainian resilience, that it wants its cities to crumble and become unlivable. And if it was able to, if it had the capability of doing so, it would overrun those cities and commit ethnic cleansing and genocide at the drop of a hat. There is no question of that. After the second anniversary of Bucha, we should remember what Russian troops do in occupied territories, and we should be terrified about what an invading Russian army could do to a city of many hundreds of thousands of people. So this seems not just to be a strong military strategy to try to erode and take out Russia's refining capacity. It can also be seen as legal because these facilities, these oil facilities, are providing fuel for strategic bombers, for vehicles, for tanks, and so on. And in fact, this is a moral imperative by the Kiev government in order to protect its citizens and to ensure that its country is not erased. It is therefore potentially reprehensible that the US would put pressure on Ukraine to stop this, perhaps the most successful strategy it has adopted in the full 2 years of war. But there are good reasons why Washington might do this. Any hint that oil prices may rise, that there could be an oil price crisis in an election year, of course, will have political advisers and politicians terrified in Washington. That is the last thing they want to happen, especially when Trump is gaining in the polls, and in a more recent poll seemed to have a 5-point lead over Biden. This perhaps illustrates why the strategy to eke out support for Ukraine in dribs and drabs has failed dramatically. If Ukraine was supplied in order to win, then this war could have potentially ended far sooner, or at least Ukraine would be in a far, far better position than it is today. The Biden government could have basked in the glow of a victory, or at least claimed it was on the way to a victory, as opposed to the quagmire that seems to have been created by this strategy to slow walk munitions, supplies, and capabilities to Ukraine. The policy of escalation management very much fits in with the story in the Financial Times about Washington also having disquiet about Ukraine hitting Russian oil refineries. But at this point in the war, I think Ukraine understands that the gloves need to come off and there is no longer any time to waste. That realization does not perhaps seem to have sunk in to the policymakers in Washington. And despite those reported hints or pressures on Zelensky to stop that strategy, it carries on apace, as we mentioned earlier, with perhaps one of the most dramatic strikes against a Russian oil facility, that is the large Tatarstan refinery. And what's the impact? Well, over the last few weeks of Ukraine carrying out these regular attacks on Russian oil refineries and in other industrial facilities with long-range drones, in total, those attacks have reportedly disrupted between 12 to 14% of Russia's refining capacity. That is huge, and it may create internal instability, put pressure on Putin's regime to draw the war to a halt as well. Now, if Ukraine was to cease this strategy, it's highly likely that Russia would be able to recover some of that lost capacity, and this would only be a temporary blip. It could then get back onto its stated objective of assaulting Ukraine. So it's vital that Ukraine carries on. Once this figure of disrupted oil capacity gets above 20, 30%, then you're going to see huge systemic issues within Russia itself. So it's critical that these continue. We also hear from a recent report that Ukraine increased its production of long-range drone capabilities starting last year. It's increased them tenfold. So we can speculate that Ukraine will have the capacity to continue these strikes, and it's both militarily and I think morally vital that they continue to do so. And another reason why it's incredibly important to create this facility to hit Russian targets at long range is in the Kyiv Independent. And this is Budanov, who warns that Russian railway in occupied Ukraine will pose a serious problem to Ukraine. Because Russia is no longer able to use the Kerch Bridge for key military supplies, they need other high capacity methods to do that. And the railway that Russia is building in unoccupied parts of Ukrainian regions could pose a serious problem for Kyiv, Budanov says. Budanov added that he believes Ukraine will be able to cope with these issues, but did not elaborate on the details. Well, that is very likely some form of long-range strike, which will be imperative to make sure that that facility does not increase Russia's military logistics. Now, Russia has been constructing that railway between the port city of Rostov-on-Don and occupied Crimea. This is an alternative to the Crimean bridge, which has increasingly come under attack by drones and is no longer considered safe as a key military transport link. Now, this new railway hooks up key occupied and strategic areas such as Donetsk, Mariupol, Donetsk Oblast, and Berdyansk in Zaporizhia. Russia has actually been building that railway for over a year now to connect with temporarily occupied southern territories. The process is almost complete, and it could pose a serious problem, says Budanov, by supplying Russian forces in greater volume on the southern front. And, of course, we can assume that that railway will become an important target for Ukrainian forces. And another reason why the pressure needs to be kept up on Moscow is because Russia will continuously find other ways to attack Ukraine if it can. And here is one of the rumored routes. Frontline report, Ukraine prepares for likely Russian assault from the Belgorod region. Now, this is a report in Euromaidan Press. Fears are growing in Ukraine over the potential for a major new Russian offensive aimed at the key northern city of Kupiansk in the Kharkiv Oblast, as intelligence detects worrying patterns of military buildup in the region. In the wake of increased activity along the border of the Belgorod region, Russian military commanders and high-ranking officials started demanding the creation of a sanitary zone, so-called. The calls for the establishment of the demilitarized zone to protect the Russian border has brought back to the forefront a potential new Russian offensive from the north. Now, there's more details in that article, and we can also link it to a worrying sign, albeit one we have to question as to whether it's a realistic prospect. And these are signs that Belarus has shifted significant numbers of troops to its border to conduct so-called military drills near the EU and Ukraine. The Belarusian military began military drills on April 2nd near its borders with Poland and Lithuania to the west and Ukraine to the south. That was announced by Belarus's defense ministry. Now, it holds regular military drills, including ones very close to the area which the current ones are being conducted in. The exercises, which the Ministry of Defense said were intended to simulate defense scenarios in the case of martial law being implemented. As the exercises were underway, Belarusian dictator and Kremlin puppet Alexander Lukashenko said that Belarus is, quote, preparing for war. Even though the country does not want to fight, the state-run media outlet Bilta reported. If you want peace, prepare for war, he said, which is paraphrasing something which many Western generals have said in relation to the fairly anemic capabilities of NATO over the last couple of decades. Belarus does not need to threaten anyone, he said, in what seems to be a fairly threatening tone. Belarus is, of course, Moscow's close ally. One could even go so far as to say it is now puppet state, an extension of the Russian state, and it's provided extensive support to Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine, namely allowing Russian troops to launch their unsuccessful offensive towards Kyiv from its territory in 2022. Despite this, the Belarusian military has not directly participated in Russia's war, and there are some good reasons for that. It has a small military and, by all accounts, is not particularly competent. Now, in the next episode of Silicon Bites, we're going to look a bit more into the terror attacks in Russia, but also look at the bigger picture of the internal terror that its government is imposing upon its people. But here's a quick summary of that incident and some of the consequences that are still unfolding. Moscow shooting aftermath, repressions, racism, and terror, says the Kyiv Independent in an extensive piece, which is definitely worth reading. The March 22nd Moscow mass shooting is likely to be used as a justification for a new wave of terror and oppression in Russia. And in fact, we have seen the announcement of a further 150,000 troops. That is potentially a consequence of this attack. It may be something that was been planned. That was being planned anyway, but the attack in Moscow is a handy way to get that news out. Russian politicians and propagandists began calling for reinstating the death penalty, a mechanism that can be used not only against terrorists, but also against the peaceful opposition. And of course, some of the propagandists have for some time now been calling for the death penalty against internal opponents of Putin's regime. Furthermore, a new wave of xenophobia has spread across the country after it was revealed that the perpetrators of the attack were most likely citizens of Tajikistan, a Central Asian country bordering Afghanistan. Millions of Central Asian migrants, primarily from Uzbekistan, Tajikistan, and Kyrgyzstan, work in Russia in construction and retail. Cases of attacks and harassment on them from ordinary citizens and the estate authorities have been recorded en masse. A Russian-born political philosopher at New York University, Sergei Sakhanov, said to the Kyiv Independent that the atmosphere of state terror is increasing in Russia. The political atmosphere is becoming more and more savage. Russian officials also have used the attack for propaganda purposes, blaming Ukraine for the mass shooting, despite there being zero evidence of Ukraine's involvement at all. Now, this is the deadliest terror attack in Russia for 20 years, and you can see some of the pictures of it flashing through in this report. At least 133 people were killed at a concert hall near Moscow in the deadliest attack in Russia since the 2004 Beslan siege. And what makes it interesting is that just 3 days before the attack, Russian President Vladimir Putin dismissed warnings issued by Western embassies that imminent terror was being planned in Moscow, and he said it's blatant blackmail and an attempt to destabilize Russian society. Of course, those Western warnings came just before the election, and Putin must have believed that these were an attempt by the West to destabilize his coronation, or at least to put a negative spin on it. It turns out that that is not the case, and of course, the attacks were real. And of course, Russia's response to this has been as demented as its response to pretty much anything else over the last couple of years. The Kyiv Independent reports that Russia has demanded extradition of Ukrainians, including the head of the SBU, after the ISIS-K attributed terrorist attack. Russia's foreign ministry called for the arrest and extradition of the head of the security services of Ukraine, the SBU, citing the March 22nd terrorist attack that's been claimed by an Afghanistan-based ISIS group, as well as other attacks which it has claimed to be involved in. Without providing any evidence at all, Russia's foreign ministry has been attempting to blame the terrorist attack on Crocus Hall outside of Moscow that killed 139 people on Ukraine. The Russian ministry said that all traces, quotes, of the attack led back to Ukraine, a claim that has been disputed by Ukraine and Western intelligence, and it seems not a shred of evidence has been provided for a single trace, let alone all of them. Following the attack, the terrorist group Islamic State claimed responsibility for the mass shooting in a Telegram post. Kyiv has dismissed the allegations of its involvement, and the White House said there was no indication that Ukraine was behind the Moscow attack. One can see that perhaps the US was simply doing its duty by announcing that. It may also have given these warnings in the strong belief that Russia might try to use this as a provocation for some kind of attack against Ukraine or an escalation of its attacks against Ukraine. So giving that intelligence, making that intelligence public, has been a feature of the US strategy right from the start. And in this case, it's absolutely understandable why they might have done that. But also, if we examine the acts of the SBU and the presumed acts of Ukrainian allied saboteurs within Russia, going back to the start of the full-scale war, we can see that almost exclusively attacks have been made against facilities connected to Russia's war machine, manufacturing facilities, logistics, distribution, and so on. Ukraine has gone out of its way not to hit civilian targets. And of course, the same cannot be said for Moscow. And wrapping this up, Clown World had an absolute field day, Clown World in Moscow, about these Crocus Hall city attacks. And this is a report from the Kyiv Post saying that Russia's absurd accusations of Western involvement in the Crocus City Hall attack become ever more bizarre, especially with the accusations that the West masterminded the March 22nd attacks, and the claims on Russian television by the former head of Russian Interpol Bureau that accuses the West of exerting mind control over the terrorists. Alexander Bortnikov, the head of Russia's Federal Security Services, accused Ukraine on Tuesday of orchestrating the attacks on Crocus City Hall with Western assistance without offering any evidence. Speaking on Russia's Channel 1 main daytime political talk show, Time Will Tell, on Saturday, Major General Vladimir Ovshinsky, who had been the head of Moscow's Interpol office from 1997 to 1999, made an even more astonishing claim that Kyiv had trained militants in the Middle East as well. He said that Western intelligence agencies could have embedded neural implants into the brains of the perpetrators, forcing them to attack the concert hall against their will. Well, Russia specializes in weaponized lies. It specializes in absurd conspiracy theories. This one, however, perhaps will not be so popular with Kremlin stooge Elon Musk. The implication here is technology like the ones he's working on may have been used by the West to create zombie terrorists. Well, that's about as long as I want to spend in Kremlin clown world. So now let's move on to the next stories. And it's important to remember what Ukraine has gone through over these 2 years. And this article in Euromaidan Press revisits Bucha and examines the fact that many people are still missing, according to Ukrainian police. And this is 2 years after the massacre of civilians in the Ukrainian town. Ukrainian police report that the liberation of Bucha from Russian forces, 422 slain civilians were found, with over 1,000 bodies discovered in the region, but many are still missing. 514 residents of the Kiev Oblast are still missing, with 180 bodies of Ukrainian citizens that have not been identified. Exactly 2 years ago, on March the 31st, 2022, Ukrainian capital Kiev's suburb of Bucha was liberated from the Russian occupation. The Bucha massacre was the mass murder of at least 422 Ukrainian civilians and POWs by Russian forces during the month-long occupation. Here is a passage written by a Ukrainian witness of the massacre. Nibitov wrote on Facebook, "Bucha, the air smells of blood. This scent will be with me forever. Torture, entire families, children killed, tortured, burned. This cannot be forgotten. After the deoccupation of Bucha, 422 murdered civilians were found, with a total of 1,190 bodies discovered in the Bucha district. And these numbers are not final. There are missing persons, and the search for them continues." Now, this passage was written by Deputy Head of Ukraine's National Police, Andrei Nebitov, and he went on to state that many of Russia's war criminals have already been identified. Over 116,000 criminal proceedings for war crimes committed by Russia in Ukraine have been initiated, with 23,000 of them taking place in the Kiev Oblast. So far, only two Russian servicemen have been formally charged with murder, and that was for executing a civilian in Bucha. But even though only two have been charged so far, many more will come. Over 100 Russian soldiers who committed war crimes in Bucha alone have now been identified. And now, a short summary of stories which you may find interesting. We will pop links to these in the description of the video below. This is a story again from Euromaidan Press, and it says that Ukraine's budget shortfall in March is in large part due to the Polish border blockade, and it amounts to $160 million. This blockade, initiated in February, has disrupted truck movement, impacting Ukraine's economy and, without question, benefiting Russia. The Polish farmers' blockade at Ukraine's state border has led to an estimated loss of $160 million from the state budget in March alone. Now, this is a story we will pick up again in future interviews. I hope to be able to speak to experts in Poland about the causes of this blockade and what can be done. My point of view is that it is morally reprehensible to be doing this against a country which is at war, and it is entirely boneheaded and strategically idiotic because Poland is also a prime target for Russian aggression. If Ukraine falls, then there's a chance that Poland will be next, and this act is definitely helping Russia in its war efforts. And another link I'm going to provide is to the Kyiv Post. And this is an interesting view by Lev Parnas, which talks about a potential Trump victory in the forthcoming election. Lev Parnas says that no one in Trump's world gave Volodymyr Zelensky any credit when he came into office. They just thought he's a comedian, he'll roll over and play ball. However, Zelensky refused the requests of Donald Trump, one of the most powerful men in the world at that time, to drum up a fake investigation into the Bidens linked to Burisma Energy. Now, of course, this is going to create some controversy, perhaps in the comments as well. Trump cultists will be screaming that this is not true. But if you are at all open-minded, it's absolutely fascinating read into the background and some of the details that may have helped form Trump's view of Ukraine. It's my personal belief that those views are not positive. It's my belief that he's prejudiced against Ukraine, and if he comes to office, will likely not be minded to help Ukraine. But what we also know about Trump is he likes to benefit financially from political decisions, from business decisions, from personal decisions. But at this point, the odds are that he will not help Ukraine to survive, and it could be extremely dangerous if he wins. I know some of you will have alternative points of view about that. Please do add them to your comments. I'm sure that will generate a lively debate. And here are two interesting stories in Nova Gazeta to finish off. And one is about why Belgorod residents who are enduring, so the article says, Ukrainian missile strikes. And of course, there is an insurgency taking place. These are Russian citizens, but armed and supported by Ukraine, as we all now realize, who are conducting an insurgency to try to take back Russian cities from Putin and from Putinism. But these Belgorod residents complain that they are abandoned by Putin and its government. And I think you can make a strong case to say that not just the Moscow regime, but many people in Moscow really would find it hard to point to Belgorod on a map and generally probably don't care too much about the fate of people there. It's only if these strikes get closer to the heart of Moscow, I think, that anyone will pay a huge amount of attention to them. Nonetheless, that's an interesting article, link below. And finally, an interesting piece. This actually is a couple of weeks old now, but it is by Leonid Gosman. He is a Russian opposition politician, and he writes, "Let there be war. The Kremlin is preparing Russians for a final showdown with the West." This article is dated 14th of March. And of course, ironically, he writes that Russia, of course, wants peace, but its hand has been forced. It's been provoked, just like Poland provoked Hitler into invading it. Those Westerners are constantly trying to bring Russia to its knees, but it's never going to happen. They just can't understand how hopeless their attempts are. Russia is internal, invincible, etc., etc. And then, of course, Leonid Gosman goes on to take that theory apart. He examines the pronouncements of Russian propagandists who threaten to turn Western cities into radioactive dust. He analyzes the militarization of Russia's youth, the brainwashing, and the extreme lies that are fed to the Russian people. Lies which have led it into a genocidal war. Lies which have only intensified in the last few years. And lies and aggression, which are unlikely to recede and diminish on their own. This is a fairly terrifying article, but it's an important read by somebody with inside knowledge of how the Russian system works and how the Russian mindset is manipulated by the Kremlin for the purposes of eternal Putinism and eternal warfare. Now, please do support Ukraine. Do check out the charities that are listed in the description of the video, and please do, at this point, write to your congressman and your representatives. It's incredibly important right now that Ukraine and the importance of Ukrainian survival and victory are made clear to your representatives. And please, if you're coming up to an election, check whether who you're voting for supports Ukraine or not. This also is critical. The next episode of Silicon Bites will be coming in a few days, and it will focus more on the attacks in Moscow, the various theories as to why they happened and who was behind them, and of course, what the consequences may be in the coming weeks, months, and years of such terror in and across Russia.